But today, we're going to be talking about angels and what angels can do. I approached that with some trepidation. I was doing a seminar once, a weekend seminar for a church on this, and I mentioned the fact that satanic beings do exist and that angels are on earth today. As a matter of fact, there's a scripture that may be a little surprising to you, which says that in 1 John chapter 5, verse 19, the whole world is under the control of the evil one. We like to think that God controls the world. The scriptures say that Satan controls the world. So when you sing, he's got the whole world in his hands, it's rather reassuring, it's just theologically incorrect. I had a guy tell me on one occasion, he said, if the devil's in control, I give up. Well, don't get mad at me by saying the devil's in control. I didn't write that. John did by inspiration of the Holy Spirit, and he controls the world. Now, if you understand that he controls the world and that these evil beings are around, and they can take any form or appearance they want, they can be invisible, they can look like human beings, they can look like inanimate objects, they can be wind or fire. Hebrews chapter 1 says that angels can be wind or fire. If you begin to understand that, then you take a wholly different perspective on the things that go on around us, and after a while you begin to believe there's very little, if any, coincidence. For example, if angels can be wind and angels can be fire, that would explain what occurred in the book of Job. Are you familiar with the book of Job? Have you heard of it? It's real simple. Now, if the question I ask is answered yes, you shake your head this way. If it's no, shake your head this way. In the book of Job, recall that the first thing that happened in the attack on Job was that a great wind blew down the house where Job's children were having a party. In our day and time, we'd probably call that a tornado. Also recall that fire fell from heaven and killed some of Job's servants and many of Job's animals. That particular phraseology, fire from heaven, is used elsewhere in the Old Testament to refer to lightning. That's what we call it today. Obviously, what occurred was that Job became exposed, came in the form of a storm, and not using lightning, not using tornadoes. These angels were lightning, were tornadoes. Angels can be wind or fire. Destroyed the house in which these children were having the party and killed people with the fire that fell from heaven. You ever read much about tornadoes and how erratic they seem to be and how unusual? I mean, why they skipped this house and hit that house over there? I'm from Augusta, Georgia. In our part of the country, we have killer tornadoes. Alabama has more killer tornadoes than any state in the Union. And also, by the way, it gives rise to some bizarre humor that we have over there. Are you familiar with Georgia humor? The prevalent joke making the rounds in Augusta, Georgia right now is this. What do an earthquake, tornado, hurricane, and redneck divorce have in common? Somebody's going to lose a trailer. So when you read about the bizarre kinds of things that tornadoes do where they hit this house and don't hit that house, I'm telling you that at least in the book of Job, it was not just a random act of nature. In the book of Job, it was directly guided by and done by angelic beings. The first thing I'll tell you that evil angels have the power to do and that they're still on earth and can still do it is that they have the power to use nature. And they can destroy you. They can kill you. Now, that's what I was saying earlier. I said that in a weekend seminar I was in with the church, and a lady jumped up and said, they may be able to kill you, but they cannot kill me. I am protected. To which my reply was, then you're better protected than was Jesus. You're better protected than was John the Baptist. You're better protected than was James the Apostle. What makes you think that they cannot harm you? They definitely can. You say, well, wait a minute. Don't we have good angels that camp around us? That's what the psalmist said. And protect us so that nothing bad can happen to us. No. There are good angels that camp around us. Occasionally, at least. But there's no passage saying that nothing bad will happen to us. As a matter of fact, we tend to avoid those passages where Jesus said things like, no person is greater than his master. They're persecuting me, therefore they are going to persecute you. Recall Jesus saying that, by any chance? We don't typically preach on that one a lot. We'd rather talk about Romans 8:28. I'm all in favor of preaching on Romans 8:28. But I want you to understand that bad things do happen to good people, and they're done by angelic beings. When Jesus, in Matthew 24, was telling the disciples about what would be coming, he said, not only will they persecute you, they will persecute you to death. There are Christians today who are being killed, just as there were Christians back then being killed, and they're being killed by angelic power. You might say, "Well, wait a minute, Joe, we don't believe that miracles occur." Well, without getting into that debate, let me at least say this. Classically, in our fellowship, we have defined a miracle as being something that contradicts nature. Isn't that correct? For example, if my leg is cut off and another one grows back, we would call that a miracle, right? On the other hand, if I break my leg and I go to the hospital, they put it in a cast and we pray that God heals it, and 6 weeks later they take the cast off and my leg is well, I would thank God for the healing, but nobody would call that a miracle. Is that right? So we say anything that contradicts nature is a miracle. Anything within the confines of nature is not miraculous at all. Here's my question. If a tornado hits your house and it blows down and kills you, was that in or outside the confines of nature? I'm sorry, I thought I'd ask you a question. Therefore, is it a miracle? As a matter of fact, if it falls on you and you don't die, that's when they'll say on the newspaper and the television, "What a miracle." If lightning strikes you and you die, is that a miracle? If lightning strikes you and you don't die, you get on television. So if you want to get on CNN, go out there and stand and pray. So angels being wind and angels being fire can bring great harm. Not only that, by the way, if you recall the book of Job, not only did they use nature, but angels also used nature in the form of sickness. Remember how that Job was struck with an illness from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. Remember that? A terrible disease. He broke pottery and scraped himself. He was in such pain. There was no position in which he could get to protect himself. He couldn't lie on either side. He couldn't lie on his back. He couldn't lie on his stomach. He couldn't even stand on his head. He had sores everywhere, and these beings did that. And angels have the ability to strike. In the book of Acts, when... I read a different Bible than you do. Obviously, right? In the book of Acts, I think it's what, about chapter 12... where that Herod was being worshipped as God. They said, "You're a God." And rather than saying, "No, I'm not a God," he said, Thank you very much. Remember what God did to him. God sent an angel. What did the angel do? He struck Herod with worms, and he died. If worms eat your insides and you die, is that a miracle? No, if worms eat your inside and die, you're dead, and that's very much according to nature. Is that not correct? On my top 10 list of ways I do not wish to die, worms is number 3. And can you imagine how that feels? I used to go around Mike telling people my preferred way is by Mack truck when I'm not looking. Now I'm paranoid every time I see a Mack truck. By the way, because of the way that God reacted when Herod received that worship as God and he struck him through an angel with worms and he died, later explains why when Paul and Barnabas, when the people came out of the city and said, "You're gods," they said, "No, no. Not us. No way at all." So angels can strike people with disease and angels can use her. That does explain why some people get... I'm not saying that illness is caused by an evil angel, but I'm saying that at least some illnesses are. And that some of the things that come to Christians that we stand back and say, "Why in the world did that happen? Why did these evil things take place?" At least some of those things occurred because those people are under spiritual attack. Why? Because no good deed goes unpunished. You say, "Where's the scripture for that?" Start in Genesis, read to Revelation. No good deed goes unpunished. If you decide you're going to serve God and serve God mightily, you attract attention of not only good beings who appreciate what you do, you attract the attention of evil beings who hate what you do, and they will do everything they can to stop you. You might be saying, "Well, Joe, our church has never been under attack, and neither has anybody in it." My response is, that means you ain't doing nothing. Pardon the use of the word "ain't." I am from Georgia, you understand. Hear about the little boy and told his teacher in class, he said, "I ain't going." She said, "Oh, no, 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 I am not going. He is not going. She is not going. We are not going. They are not going." Kid said, "Sound like ain't nobody going to me." I can assure you that if you don't want angelic attack, what you can do is do nothing. If you're no threat to them, they have little use to bother with you. There's somebody else they'll attack. And so you can sit there as a church and do nothing. You can sit there as a person and do nothing and have relative peace, except for the occasional passing angel who'll do harm to you just because it's fun to do. I'm serious. They will do that. You see, the reason they want to hurt us is because they hate God and they can't fight Him. Remember the imagery in Revelation chapter 12. It there talks about the birth of Jesus. The woman's about ready to deliver a child. It says, this child shall rule all nations with a rod of iron. That's Jesus. It says that the dragon is waiting for the child's birth. Verse 9 describes the dragon as being the devil. Now, this is an occasion when Jesus was born onto earth, and the dragon's waiting to devour him. Michael, the archangel, comes from heaven with his army. Satan takes his army and meets them in the heavens. They begin to have a great and furious battle. Remember that? It says that Satan was cast from heaven. Don't misunderstand that imagery. That's not saying that's the first time he was cast from heaven. It was just simply saying he lost in the war to Michael. As they're having this battle and he's losing, what's happening on earth? Recall what's happening on earth physically while angels fight in the heavens. 2-year-old and younger children are being slaughtered on earth. It is my opinion that any time any great catastrophe is occurring on the earth, there is a spiritual war going on just above it between the good and the evil forces. And they're fighting mightily. God couldn't be attacked in heaven. Satan didn't have the power. He tried to attack Jesus when he came to earth, and Michael defeated him. And according to Revelation chapter 12, then he turned on the woman. There is different speculation as to whether the woman represents the Jewish nation or represents the church. Be that as it may, the second or the last point is that after he turned on the woman, he turned on all those who would follow the Son that came. He hates you and he hates me because he hates our Father. He cannot successfully attack heaven, so he attacks us because he hates our Father. By bringing any pain into my life, he has brought pain into the Father's life who loves me. The other reason he attacks is not only to hurt the Father and hurt me, but by hurting me, he may, just may, convince me to give up on God and go the other direction. Have you ever seen people who, under spiritual attack, rather than strengthening their faith, abandon their faith? If a person happens to abandon his faith and leaves God and lose his salvation, think what will happen in the next life. God will reign in heaven. Satan will reign in hell. Now, I realize that Satan will be in torment in hell just like I, if I were to be there. But if you put a bunch of people in prison, they're all being punished, will there wind up being a hierarchy of order and authority? Do the meaner, badder prisoners bring pain and harm to those that are weaker and less evil than that? I can assure you that one other reason they want you not to go to heaven is not just because they hate the fact you can go where they cannot go, not just the fact they hate your Father and therefore hate you, but if they can deceive you into hell, you will serve them there. If there's anything that can add to the torment and punishment of hell, that must be it. And so here they work, doing everything they can to misfocus us, to deceive us and misdirect us. They do it through pain, through nature, through disease. They do it through circumstance and situation. They do it through manipulation. These beings do everything they can to deceive us. Their primary weapon is seduction. They try to turn you away from God in any way they can. Now, how well do they know you? I had a fellow ask me once, he said, I heard a preacher say, if I pray silently, then evil beings cannot know what I pray about. If I pray out loud, they can know what I pray about, and they will stand in defeat of me. Therefore, this preacher said, pray silently, only God can hear. Do you think praying silently then protects you from evil beings know what you pray? Can evil beings communicate to you in any way other than through your five senses? Let's think about it for a minute. What are the five senses? There's smell. It's always first with me, Mark. There's smell, taste, sight, hearing, and touch. Is that correct? Did I get all five? Did anybody keep up? I mean, did we get all five? When I was a young preacher, they used to teach us, and therefore we taught others, that the only way you can ever be communicated to is through your five senses. If you can't see it or smell it or touch it or whatever, then it can't be communicated to you. And the reason we taught people that when I was a young preacher was because we were afraid they might think the Holy Spirit was speaking to them and go off and be Pentecostal. So we told them that they could only be communicated to through the five senses. Therefore, the only way God can communicate to them is through the Word. Have you guys ever preached that? I'm the only one in the country. You ever preach that? Sure, we used to preach that. Now, there's only one thing wrong with that particular theology, and that is it is incorrect. You know, I was talking to my brother-in-law, Billy Hillier, who's the president of Faulkner University, and Dr. E.R. Branham, one day we were having lunch, and we were talking about how you grow and learn as you continue to grow in your Christian life, and we came to the conclusion the one bad thing about continuing to mature spiritually is you have to throw away some really good sermons. How many of you preachers have had that experience, right? What's wrong with it is this. Remember that three times the angels talked to Joseph, the father, actually the husband of Mary, the mother of Jesus. Remember? All three times those angels talked to Joseph. How did they address him? Through dreams. Do you smell a dream? Do you see it? Do you hear it? Do you feel it? A dream is something that occurs totally in thought process. Yet angels of God could get into Joseph's dreams and communicate to him through that means. That means that you can be communicated to by spiritual beings other than through your five senses. Is that correct? Now, right along here, you're saying, wait a minute, Joe, if you say that, then you're saying that sometimes the thoughts that comes into a person's head may not originate just with the person. That is exactly right. Sometimes the thoughts that are in your head did not originate with you. Sometimes they originate with God or one of God's messengers. Sometimes they originate with Satan or one of Satan's messengers. And sometimes they do originate from your own evil desire or your own good desire. You say, well, wait a minute. If a thought can come from some evil being or some good being, if the thoughts are not always my own, then how should I know which thoughts to listen to? Oh, no, that makes sense. Paul told Timothy to try the spirits to see which one was from God. Is that correct? Now, here's how I can try the spirit. I have the word as my standard. I can open this up and say, now, wait a minute. If that urge is contradictory to this, then there's got to be a problem. If that urge is in harmony with this, then it's okay. It really doesn't make a lot of difference if it's from God or from me. It's still good. It's still holy. And so this is the standard that is unimpeachable. This is the standard that is unquestionable. But haven't you on some occasion had an urge to do something? Maybe it was to pick up the phone and make a call. Maybe it was to go see somebody. Maybe it was to do whatever. And when you got there or did that thing, it was the right place at the right time to accomplish something that never would have been accomplished otherwise. How many of you have experienced that at some point? At the risk of being written off this stage, I'm telling you that's God or one of God's messengers. On the other hand, how many of you have had some urge or desire to go do some particular thing, and when you did, you found yourself in the middle of the biggest temptation you've ever had in your life? I'm telling you that's not God. There are evil beings who know you very well because of the fact they can communicate directly into your mind. You see, I think at no stretch of the imagination at all, if they can communicate into my mind, then they can communicate from my mind. What I mean by that is they can know what I'm thinking. If I can pray silently and God can hear, I think any other spiritual being can too. Perhaps that's what is meant by the language of angels. And so here it is, that they can see into my mind, they can understand what I think, and they know me extremely well. Now, I doubt the devil himself knows you. I don't mean to offend you by that. But the devil is an angel, therefore he is finite. He is not God. He is not omnipotent. He does not have all power. He is not omniscient. He doesn't know everything. He is not omnipresent. He is not every place. Sometimes I'll ask people, where do you think the devil is? They'll say, right here. I don't know where the devil is, but I know he can't be every place at one time. He is not God. He is not the Holy Spirit. The devil is finite, but because he has angels that rule the world, and angels that work for them, and angels that work for them, I'll guarantee you there's at least one who knows you very well. Knows you by name, knows your strengths, knows your weaknesses, and that angel will do everything that he can to manipulate you by arranging circumstances and situations in such a way as to deceive you away from God. If they can do it by hurting you, they will bring pain. If they can do it by giving you pleasure, they'll do that. As often as not, they bring it through religion itself. Pride, piety, right? Have a whole chapter in the coming book about how Satan uses religion. Won't get into that right now because we'll start a brouhaha right here. I'd rather you buy the book and then you can just write me a letter and can't hit me physically. But he uses religion, piety, false piety, just like he uses pleasure and like he uses pain. He will come at you with whatever will best work on you. Do you know any human being well enough that you can manipulate them? Any daughters in the house? My wife and I have three daughters. Our oldest is 23. Our next is 16. Our next is 4. That's right. 23, 16, and 4. We decided to have our own grandchildren. Just skip those middlemen, go right to it. My daughters can manipulate me with ease. They have learned me well enough they can predict my probable behavior based on what they do in a certain situation. They come up and say, Daddy, please. And they get anything they want. My four-year-old has a Ferrari. I'm exaggerating. It's really only a Mercedes, but... But the idea is, if I know a human being well enough that I can so arrange circumstances and situations as to cause a probable course of behavior based on how well I know them, then can't an evil being do the same? For example, how many times do you think that somebody that has a particular weakness toward a particular temptation winds up in concert with somebody else who has the same weakness toward the same temptation? Let's just put it out like it happens. How many of you have ever known a preacher or an elder that wound up counseling somebody and then wound up having some kind of a sexual affair with them? Anybody ever heard of that? Now, typically we think, well, what a pervert. Look at this sick man. It may be that that's the case. But a lot more of the times what happens is you have a person here that has certain needs being unmet, certain desires being unfulfilled, certain problems in their lives they can't figure out how to solve, and here comes another person introduced into their life by evil beings who realize the probable course of behavior. If they put these two people into the same situation or same circumstance, this person gets introduced into the life who has a similar need or problem or desire, and the inherent weaknesses in both of them begin to seek out the weaknesses in the other, and neither one of them even puts up a defense because they don't realize what's happening. And the next thing you know, they're doing things that are decidedly ungodly, but they have been able by this point to rationalize and justify it all, and they're committing evil acts. Does that occur? Well, let's take it out of the realm of some preacher or elder who's had an affair, and I'm not justifying affairs, you understand? I'm explaining how things happen. Haven't you on occasion sinned? Any perfect people in the house? A Baptist preacher friend of mine told me he tried to make that point at church one day. He said, is anybody here perfect? And the guy in the back of the church building stood up. The preacher thought, now what am I going to do? He said, pardon me, sir, but are you perfect? He said, no, I'm standing for my wife's first husband. There is no such thing as a perfect person. You sin. Why do you sin? Because these beings come along and they tempt you. Are you familiar with Freudian psychology? Have you heard of Freud? I had a professor in college who didn't know how to pronounce it. Called him Fraud the whole time. Freud, even though he was a non-believer, did have some things about humanity figured out. Freud described, I'm just going to use this for an illustration. This is not a class in Freudian psychology. Freud figured out that a person basically had three components in his being. One was what he called the id, the ID. The id is, let me draw it this way. Draw a big circle as big as my body and write the word id in your mind there. Can you see that? Then you had another part of you, which is your consciousness, the part of you that deals with the world. Draw a circle about the size of my head and call that the consciousness, or what Freud called it was the ego, E-G-O, from the Latin word I. Then Freud believed we had a conscience. Now, draw another little line out here that tacks onto the top of the consciousness. That's the conscious. And Freud called that the superego. Freud believed that your superego was programmed by your teachers and your parents and your preachers or priests or whatever. And that conscience only existed because people put it there. Now, Freud had a thing called the pleasure principle. The pleasure principle is what the id operates by. Here's the example they'll give you in Psychology 101. The id just wants what it wants when it wants it. It doesn't care what's right. It doesn't care what's wrong. It just cares about what it wants. The superego, on the other hand, is the conscience. It has certain standards by which it lives. The ego is the part that interacts with the world and says, this is what I will do, this is what I will not do. Now, the Psych 101 illustration. You're walking down the street, see an apple cart, beautiful red apples. Reach in your pocket, you have no money. The id says, I want what I want when I want it. Get the apple. Steal it. The superego says, it is wrong to steal. Don't steal this thing. We'll come back later when you have money. Now, the ego has to make a decision what to do. And no matter what decision it makes, now part of you will be unhappy. If you go past the apple cart and don't buy it, the id says, I wanted that. And it feels empty and longing, and the desire just gets stronger and stronger. If, on the other hand, you do steal it, the superego says, you are a bad boy. You shouldn't have done that. You say, well, wait a minute. What's that got to do with Christianity? Here's how Paul would describe that in the book of Romans. He called what Freud called the id the sarx. That's the Greek word, S-A-R-X. In the King James Version, it is translated as the word flesh. The New International Version translates it as sinful nature. Some people rejected the New International Version when it came out precisely because it used the word sinful nature. They thought that smacked of Calvinism, and since we don't believe Calvinism, it has to be wrong. A lot of our theology is what I call reactionary theology. So I ask these people often, well, what is the flesh? Well, the flesh is part of me that wants what it wants when it wants it. The flesh is a part of me that is weak. The flesh is part of me that sins. Well, why don't we just call it the sinful nature then? It seems to make sense to me. Call it the id for all I care. Just understand what it is. The flesh is the part of you that's very large and wants what it wants when it wants it. Anybody here have that part? What Freud called the superego or the conscience is what Romans chapter 8 calls the spirit-controlled mind. When you have a spirit-controlled mind, that is a conscience that's not just been programmed by society. It is a conscience programmed by God Himself through the Holy Spirit. Now, if you have a spirit-controlled mind, there's another part of you, then your mind, that must make a decision about what it will do. And when it faces temptation, there's a big part of you called the flesh, the sarx, the sinful nature that says, I want that. There's another part of you, if you're a Christian, that's the spirit-controlled mind that says, that's wrong. And then your consciousness, your mind has to make a decision as to which one you're going to yield to. Now, these beings are out there tempting this flesh all the time, realizing where it's weakest. Because some things that tempt you don't tempt me, and some things that tempt me don't tempt you. And so they look for the weakness in each person. Make sense? The illustration I've used for 20 years, if they backed a truck up right there and dumped a whole load of cocaine, it would not tempt me a bit to take a sniff. Not once. One of my psychiatrist friends said, why not? I said, with his nose, who could afford it? On the other hand, there's certain temptations that if I knew they were within 10 miles of this center, I'd be tempted to want to go where they are. You say, like what? I say, like none of your business. But I know there's certain things that tempt me and certain things that tempt you. Have you ever gone through a scenario like this? All of a sudden, you wind up where this temptation is. What a coincidence. Something that tempts you, not me. Isn't that a wonderful coincidence? These beings want to make sure you wind up at the right place at the right time for the wrong weakness. And so you stand there and there's a temptation. If you're going through this process, you look at it and you say, I want that. And another part of you, the spirit-controlled mind says, that's wrong. Don't do it. Leave. Flee. Run. And as you turn and start to go, the other part of you says, just a minute, can't we talk about this? Now, look at this. Now, whether you're doing this through some kind of a conscious process or subconscious process, the next thing that occurs is, you're looking at that and that part of you says, if we leave now and don't do this, there'll always be a part of us that will wonder what it would have been like. And besides, God is a gracious God. And He'll forgive you. Just try it this once. Besides me, anybody here ever done something like that? And then after you leave, the spirit-controlled mind kicks back in and says, that's no good. And then the devil, taking advantage of that, jumps back in here and says, that's right, you're rotten. These angelic beings want to tempt you into sin, and then once you have committed the sin, they want to use your own guilt against you to make you feel worse, so that you can be even that much more temptable to the next sin. You say, wait a minute, if I feel worse, I'm less able to be tempted by the next temptation. No, it's actually the other way around. The less you feel in control of yourself spiritually, the more you can be tempted the next time. Doesn't that make sense? If you've been out in the yard working under the car and you're full of grease and your neighbor comes by and says, help me change my oil, you don't think twice about it because you're dirty already. If it's Sunday morning, you're going out the door to Sunday school and the neighbor says, help me change the oil in my car, you say, this is my best suit. Got it at Walmart. I can't get this thing dirty. When you feel clean, you want to stay clean. When you feel dirty, it's easier to get dirty again. And so they start working on you, making you feel guilty. You've gone through that process, right? And so they tempt you with your weaknesses by putting the right circumstances and situations in front of you. And they tempt me with my weaknesses by putting the right temptations and circumstances in front of me. And if they can get me then to yield to my false piety or my pleasure or my pain, they can lead me from God. And so if they look at you and think that your faith may be a little weak, they may decide to make you sick. If they look at you and think that you love someone more than you love God, they will do everything they can to bring pain into that someone's life. Because by hurting that one that you love more than you love God, they can erode faith. Does that make sense? Now, pleasure, pain. Let's talk about the piety just for a minute. Obviously, there are hypocrites in church. Would you agree? What is a hypocrite? It's from a Greek word that means an actor. It's a person who plays a part. I don't get to see many movies, but I get to hear about a lot of them because I listen to CNN and I read USA Today. Anthony Hopkins is apparently a very good actor. Have you ever seen him perform? Ever heard of him? Apparently he played some kind of a cannibal in a movie called Silence of the Lambs. Is that right? Won an Academy Award for that role, did he not? Now he's in a movie out where he's playing C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis is the guy who wrote all those Christian books that people still buy and read because it was so profound and so deep. Here's a man who can play a cannibal criminal and also play a profound Christian writer and play either part equally well because he's an actor. We stand back and we look at that and say, woo, we marvel at that talent. I'm telling you, you see better talent than that every Sunday morning. Because at least you know that Anthony Hopkins is not the cannibal and he's not C.S. Lewis. It's just a part he plays. And there are people that come to church on Sunday morning who play their part so convincingly, you think they are people of God who love him with all their hearts when they are not at all. So hypocrites are used to hurt the church. But the biggest disease that they use to deceive us is self-righteousness. Because self-righteousness is not condemned like hypocrisy. Self-righteousness is proclaimed as being the path. What I mean by that, look in the book of Romans sometimes and you'll find, let me just give you three chapters in Romans and this will be enough for today on angels. Romans chapter 6 talks about that if we are going to be open to God, we must be dead to sin, right? Remember the word death, what does it mean? Death means separation, right? Remember back Karen Quinlan back in the early 70s when they tried to figure out who was dead? Remember that? She took gin and Valium, went into a coma. I was talking to a medical doctor back then and I said, you doctors are so educated you can't see the forest for the trees. He said, what do you mean? I said, I was a preacher back in those days. I, a lowly preacher, can tell you when somebody's dead. He said, yeah, when? James 2:26, when the body leaves the spirit, or the spirit leaves the body. He said, okay, when does that happen? I said, you're the doctor, you figure that out. It means to separate. Physical death, the separation of spirit and body. Romans chapter 6 says death to sin. What that means is this. Now, I believe in grace. I was preaching on grace 15 years ago when preaching on grace wasn't cool. Okay? I believe in grace. But I'm also quite convinced that a number of Christians can hear the flesh much better than they can hear the spirit-controlled mind because they have rationalized and justified some particular sin to the point that they have walled off the spirit-controlled mind. They still live godly lives in everything else, but they commit one sin and don't feel like it's sin anymore. You ever met anybody like that? I was counseling a guy several years ago having an affair. At the end of the counseling session, we went down to the 7-Eleven for a big gulp. You guys ever had a big gulp? Bought it from a person that didn't speak English. We went down there, and as we were leaving, the person behind the counter gave this man 2 cents too much money. As we got to the door, he realized he had 2 cents too much, and he walked back, and he gave the guy the 2 cents and said, you gave me too much change. As he walked back to the door, I stood there looking at him. He looked at me, and he said, I know what you're thinking. How can a man be having an affair, cheating on his wife, and still not be able to steal 2 cents? Well, I understand it. I've seen too many Christians that whatever the sin is, once it becomes justified and rationalized, you don't feel any guilt about that anymore, but you still think you're open to God and everything else. As a matter of fact, they don't even tempt you much in anything else. You know why? They want you to believe you're pious. They want you to believe that you really are in the will of God and doing good. And therefore, they'll help you live a very holy life in everything else that you do, except this one thing you've got rationalized. Hear me well. Romans chapter 6 says you must die to sin to hear the Spirit of God. If you have any kind of filter, any kind of bricks in that wall between your consciousness and your spirit-controlled mind, even if it's only a brick, you are not listening to God any longer. And self-righteousness says, but I go to church every Sunday. I don't miss Sunday night. I'm there every Wednesday. I read a chapter a day. I pray 20 minutes. Blah, 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 blah. My response is, so what? You've got to die to sin to hear God. You cannot be rationalizing or justifying even one. And I believe in grace. But I don't believe in cheap grace. Chapter 7 says, then you must die to the law. Actually, he's talking about the Old Testament law, but he's carrying through the point what I'm saying right here, which is, if you think you're going to heaven because you've done this, 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 and this, and you've got your checklist, then you still can't listen to the Spirit of God. You're still looking to you. And that is the self-righteousness that they work against you. They will help you do that and help you do it well because you still aren't listening to God. You're listening to you. Your faith is not in God. Your faith is in your own obedience. Right? Romans chapter 8 says, chapter 6 says, die to the law, sin. Chapter 7 says, die to the law. Chapter 8 says, you got to die to you. And that's how you have the Spirit-controlled mind. And they'll do everything they can to deceive you so that won't happen. For those of you, by the way, who are rationalizing and justifying a sin, and out of an audience this size, I know that some of you are, let me tell you something. The reason that no one has found out, the reason you're getting away with it, is because it suits their purposes. I'm talking about the bad guys. The angelic beings who hate you. They will protect you and keep you from being found out as long as it suits their purposes. When they will get more good from exposing you for their cause than they're getting now by protecting you, it will be they themselves who expose you. Remember Proverbs 5, it talks about the man, the adulterous man, it says he'll be ruined in the whole congregation. I know a church went on for years trying to make some things occur. Finally decided after having put it off for years to do a building program. Do you think there's any more vulnerable time for a church than in the middle of a building program? You kind of get vulnerable to all kinds of things then, right? Borrow hundreds of thousands of dollars. Everybody wants something this way or that way or the other. Right in the middle of their building program, their elder that had the most charisma, their elder everybody loved and loved to follow, left his wife. Right in the middle of it, for another woman. I found out about it after the fact, drove over to that town, went to see his other elders. He's no longer an elder, of course. Went to see the other elders in that church and said, look, he's salvageable. You need to discipline him immediately so we can win him back. Then I went and found him, took him to Shawnee's, and said, look, you know I love you. You know we're friends. I want to tell you why I'm in town. I came to beg your church to disfellowship so we can save yourself. Didn't work immediately, although I'm convinced that someday it will. It didn't work immediately. They went on into the building program already now in a bad situation. They borrowed all this money and the church is still reeling because nobody could believe this guy would do that. When the preacher was arrested, made the paper, he had made a pass at a boy and a shower. Interestingly enough, they discovered that he had been arrested several times before in nearby cities. He'd been a preacher of that church nearly 20 years and been arrested several times and had never, ever been exposed. It never made the newspaper. It never made the television. It never made anything. How do you think he got away with it? I'm convinced he had help. And now, when they get the most value from it, because now the elder has just gone off in immorality and the church is reeling in shock in a very vulnerable position, now they take the preacher who's been there long enough that some of the people that he baptized as young people now are deacons in the church. He's performed their marriage ceremony, and now they all find out that he's been involved in homosexuality for years and years and years, and it's on the front page of the newspaper. Do you think the church is reeling even more in shock? I called the ex-elder, my buddy. I said, how does it feel being used? He said, what do you mean being used? Think this thing through with me, I said. Walk back to that story I just walked through with you. He'd lived it, but I just wanted to remind him of each salient point and said, now, they obviously had set you up for a couple of years, didn't they? Yeah. They've been setting another thing up for years and years and years, hadn't they? Yeah. Do you think it's a coincidence that all comes out at the same time, one after the other, like dominoes? You think it's coincidence that your church is sitting in this vulnerable position? It'll take them a decade at the least to get over this. And not only that,
there'll be hundreds of people who will never be one to Jesus because of what's occurred to you and this man. How does it feel being used? It's been a couple of years now and the church is still reeling. They're still not over. Still having other problems. So if you're sitting here justifying or rationalizing some things, saying, well, you know, surely God can't be upset with this because I don't get caught. Surely God's not mad at me because I can keep on doing it. I'm telling you that it's not God protecting you. It's evil angels protecting you. They want you to do it. And when it best suits their needs, they're going to expose you, to humiliate, destroy, and hopefully defeat you and everybody who loves you. You see, as important as you are, you probably aren't even the target. The target's bigger than you. And they're using you to get to it. Now tomorrow, if you come to the class, I'm going to be talking about how God uses the devil against himself. When the devil brings pain into our life, God actually brings good things from it. And there's some things that God actually uses the devil to do. I realize that we're just touching the hem of this garment. We recommend, of course, to you the book coming out by Howard sometime this spring. They have threatened to kill me if I don't finish it immediately. I said, that's not very Christian. They said, we know. But after we kill you, we'll repent and we'll still go to heaven, but you'll still be dead. If you would like not to wait for the book, there's some yellow forms up here. We have 6 hours of tape on this. You can go ahead and order the tapes now and listen to 6 hours of great detail of all this if you'd like. And like I said, there's order blanks up here for that. Or you can wait and buy the book. And I do encourage you, if you're interested in how the devil works, tomorrow we will look specifically at how he uses pain and how God uses the pain against him. And if you come, you may leave the class realizing something God's preparing you for that you never knew before. You may leave still under persecution, but excited about it because you see what's going to come. Thank you. Now, Eric, get in there. We'll do your piece in mind.